Hello and welcome to Victory Points. I'm Becca Scott.
And I'm Jake Michaels.
And this is a podcast about people who love tabletop games interviewing other people who love tabletop games about the tabletop games they love. But not today, because we have a very, 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 very special guest. Our guest today is Meredith Levine. Meredith is a fanthropologist. What is that, you ask? Exactly what the portmanteau sounds like. She helps brands and media companies create better strategies for building and sustaining fandoms, most recently for Theorist Media. Meredith worked at Troika, which is a brand experience and design company, on a foundational research study to help understand the universal pillars of the fan experience, no matter what someone is a fan of, and the differentiating markers that make communities and fans extinct. Distinct.
What alleviates the experience.
This is all about destroying fans. She got her start working in the intersection of online video and fandom while with the firm Zephyr, and has her master's from UCLA in critical media studies with an emphasis in fan studies. This is the longest bio I've read. You are so accomplished. I also gather from Meredith's Twitter that she is also a fan of my girl E-dubs, Elizabeth Warren. So we're kindred spirits. Meredith, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I love Elizabeth Warren. That's what I'm really going to talk to you about for an hour.
Right. It's all just going to be, I stan.
And your fandom. Absolutely.
Oh, it is a fandom.
It is a fandom.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
It's like the way that people treat it. I would say that we are entering into like the next 18 months of political
fandom. Yeah,
wow.
Sure.
I did buy a t-shirt already that says Warren has a plan for that. But I have a plan for this episode, and that is to not do what we normally do, which is talk about you and then talk about the games you love. Well, I guess we will do those things, but we're mostly going to talk about your super, super interesting research. So to kick it off, how do you define fanthropologist in a little more elaborate way than...
Well, I think it has to do with what I study and the methodologies that I use, namely anthropological research methods. And my preferred methodology is netnography, which is a qualitative social listening approach. So a lot of brands and media companies will have social listening software. And a lot of what that tells people is who's talking, how many uses of a hashtag were there, and what are the related interest groups and things like that. But a lot of that is quantitative data, as opposed to reading into the cultural contexts of what's happening on social media.
So just
and
strictly,
the footprints.
Strictly aggregating like the numbers, as opposed to you guys kind of reading into what those
right.
mean.
Right, okay. Because everything exists in a cultural context. Mm-hmm. And so while you can have numbers in the absence of context are reasonably meaningless numbers.
Sure.
And so understanding the social landscape, the cultures and norms of platforms, the cultures and norms of fandoms, and the footprints that fans leave behind when they are fans on the internet. That being said, I've done a bunch of other methodologies. We've done things like, when I was on the research study, we did a lot of things like digital ethnography, which is a lot of confessional work. Ethnography is generally like a participant observation style research method. We did a big, big, big quantitative survey, big by meaning 8,000 participants with a representative sample over the United States. And our opening question got over 35,000 unique responses of what do you consider yourself to be a fan of? And so I've done a bunch of other methodologies, but my preferred is really understanding the contexts of the footprints we leave behind on the internet.
Wow. Okay. So you take these large groups of numbers and you turn them into something meaningful for the brand who's gathered those numbers.
Or rather, I mean, if you're triangulating data in a way that I think is most useful, you are finding those user stories and understanding that culture and then using other methodologies to follow up with it to be like, oh, I'm seeing this pattern online. Are these people small and loud, or is this how everybody feels?
So what's an example of that? Like, what's a methodology you would follow?
So it would be something like, not that I've done this as a study, but if I were to do this as a study, it would be hypothetically say there's a fandom that is loud and angry about a casting decision.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Great example.
Or a finale
or something. If the internet conversation is like, hey, we're loud and angry about this, you'd want to pull a sample of people who are aware and unaware of the property or whatever it is and ask about it, and then find usually brands will have in-house sample of their customer base or their audience already, and then you'd pull that audience because the people who are talking on the internet
aren't necessarily the representative of who they're buying.
Right.
Already.
It represents the sample of people who are on the internet and leaving big loud footprints.
Right.
But that's not necessarily how everyone feels. And so it's important to get what isn't being said as opposed to what is being said. Because if all of the research were based on the footprints that people leave behind, it paints a really terrible picture for a lot of audiences and a lot of fandoms that isn't necessarily true about the fandom writ large. It's just true about emotional moments that people who have large platforms get emotional about.
Yeah,
which isn't to say their feelings aren't valid. It's just to say that
they're loud.
They're loud. Yeah.
What do the quiet ones want?
What do the quiet ones want?
You can't change your strategy just based on the loud people.
Right.
Yeah.
What do the quiet ones want? And
ooh, it sounds like a vampire movie.
Yeah. So that's kind of about the methodologies that I use. I mean, I have used analytics data. I've done a lot of things, but the ones I like are finding those stories and finding those footprints and finding that nuance. And in an ideal world, being able to follow up with those people and ask them about stuff.
So, go ahead.
I wanted to know how big a field of study this is in academia. Is fan studies a new and emerging thing? Are you one of the few that's pioneering this type of research? And, of course, more will come.
No, this is a reasonably, I mean, not old, like the way that, like, art history is old. But, like, like, art history has been around as long as there's been art. But fan studies has been around roughly since about 1992 when two different books were published. One was called Textual Poachers and the other one was called Enterprising Women. Textual Poachers was about fandom and remix culture, and Enterprising Women was studying the female contributions to the Star Trek fandom in the 70s and 80s.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so both of those books were published academically in 1992, and that kind of kicked off the academic discipline. That being said, it's oftentimes coursework, not necessarily like majors. But one of the professors who pioneered this field teaches at USC. His name is Henry Jenkins, and his work has been largely credited, although he's not like the only person who's pioneered this field, but his work is credited oftentimes as being some of the seminal work in fan studies. And
So it's
been around for a while. I'm not the
it's
first
a big
person.
Deal.
I'm not the first person to use this job title. I won't be the last person to use this job title. And as for how we're employed and what we do, there are small groups of fandom professionals across the country who do everything from deep dives into specific fandoms for acquisition and content development, or for marketing, or for impact studies at the tail end of those things. So
do you guys all come from the same realm of from an anthropological standpoint?
No.
Right?
In fact, the anthropological research methodologies that I use now aren't my academic discipline. They're stuff I picked up on the job in traditional market research on this study, working underneath the tutelage of a woman named Susan Kresnicka, who's done a lot of entertainment market research. But some people do have anthropological backgrounds academically. A lot of people have media studies backgrounds in some capacity or another.
And the anthropological methodologies that you have picked up are, is this the sort of like survey type of thing, or is it the interpretation of that survey?
Yes, and I mean, surveys have been around for a very long time. Focus groups are a traditional market research method that I guess qualifies anthropology also a little bit. A lot of anthropology, though, is in field doing participant observation of like watching people in their environments. So netnography as a method was largely pioneered and written by a professor at USC called Rob Kozinets, who has written an entire book on the subject. But it's whatever method is best suited to answer. It's whatever methods, plural, ideally, if you're doing custom research, are best suited for answering the questions that are being asked. Oftentimes the questions that I get asked are about like influencers and social media presences and algorithms and things like that. So a lot of what I do is about internet footprints, but there are many other people who study all sorts of other elements and work in other elements of fandom, like making franchises out of IP and how do you create texts. I have a friend in the industry who her company Chaotic Good does a lot of like franchise building work. There are firms, one called Fanthropology, who does a lot of like deep dives into individual and specific fandoms on behalf of brands. So there are a few in
but
the
yours
field.
Is more widespread.
I'm a little bit more of a gun for hire than necessarily like fixed in one particular kind of problem solving or one particular business model.
Okay. Now, I want to get into influencers a little bit later, but let's talk about what you found in that study or just like little examples that you're allowed to share about the types of answers people give when asked, what are you a fan of?
So most people in the United States, this is a national, like the research we conducted was with people in the United States. So I can't really speak in an expert sort of way about international markets. That being said, there's international fandom, tons of it. And there's like cross and multinational fandom, like K-pop has a huge presence in the United States now, and so does anime and stuff like that.
Is it a defining factor of a fan that you say woot when someone says something that you consider yourself?
That emotional enthusiasm is one of those defining factors, and like feeling really excited about it and using it as a point to express and connect. But in the United States, most people are a fan of something, or at least would consider themselves to be a fan of something.
Now, when we met, we've shouted out the Magic Castle on this podcast before, and we'll do it again. We met at the Magic Castle.
Woot.
And just started, woot. Yep, it goes on your survey response, question number one. But I was there with my sister-in-law, and she was saying, I don't think I'm really a fan of something. Is she very much an outlier?
Some people are not. About 22-ish% of people in the United States don't consider themselves to be a fan of anything. And
it's sad. It's deeply sad.
Is that because the word fan means something different to them?
It can be because the word fan, we didn't study that negative space, but I have a few hunches. One is that the word fan means something to them.
In a different way. Like they need to be a flag waving
right.
about that thing.
Like yeah.
they
like, picture,
I'm not
they
a
picture
liberal,
someone,
yeah. but I love the idea of universal healthcare.
Or like, for some people, they don't need more. There isn't that hunger and that craving there. They're perfectly satisfied with
I am entertained
what is
by
there.
This. Sure.
Right.
Sure, yeah.
Like this was nice.
It suffices.
This was nice. The end, I feel full. as opposed to no more, please. Like I want to know
stop.
Everything about
yeah,
this
yeah.
thing. Like
people must know this is my favorite, and so I must have all the merch.
Right. Or like I need to know every single detail ever. Or this sparks off so much creativity in my mind that I'm going to cosplay this or mash
yeah.
it up with my other favorite thing. Or imagine everybody as sports team people or whatever it's going to be. Whatever that imagination is going to take them, wherever that's going to take them. There are all sorts of ways to do this. But yeah, about some people are not fans, and maybe that's because the word fan has been pathologized to be a little bit synonymous with crazy, which is not the case.
Well, does it come from fanatic?
It does come from the word fanatic.
Yeah, which isn't generally a great term.
Right. I mean, that word has a lot of history. And sometimes it's you just have a picture in your mind of like what a fan is and like sleeping for 12 hours in a queue for Hall H, and there are some people are just like, I would never do that.
Yeah.
And so there's this distance happening, but for a lot of people, they consider themselves to be a fan of something or multiple things.
Yeah, I guess it is your degree of what you consider fandom too, right? Because I mean, there's not a lot of things that I consider myself
Make
a
your
fan
list.
Of a lot
Make
of
your
things.
Make your list, go, Jake.
I consider myself a fan of Dungeons and Dragons. I consider myself a fan of Game of Thrones. I consider myself a fan
Thank
of
you.
538. But I wouldn't necessarily stand in line
a
for
polling,
any of those
a
things.
A political polling organization is number three on your list of fandoms.
I'm looking around the room and I see podcasts, so that's what I just assumed. But like, I don't know if I'd stand in line for 12 hours for any of those things, but like, I still, mm-hmm. I consider myself a fandom. But that's the thing. It's varying degrees.
Yeah, and just because you wouldn't do a thing doesn't mean you love it any less or it isn't part of your identity in the same way.
Right.
Like, if I were to, I'm also one of those people who would not stand in line for 12 hours, but there's nothing wrong with people who do.
Right, sure.
And that doesn't mean I'm any less of a fan of the things that I mm-hmm. am a fan of. I'm a big Disney theme park fan. And
we had a Diz nerd as she dubbed herself on the podcast a couple weeks ago. Chelsea Schwartz. Anyway.
Yeah.
So you are a Diz nerd.
Yes. And some people, yeah. And so I've been to three of the parks and resorts. I haven't been to the Asia ones yet, but they're on the list. But again, even as a Disney theme park fan and an annual pass holder here, I don't stand in line for new things for an excessive amount of time. It's not how I express my fandom.
Right. That's what I'm getting at. It's how you express your fandom with is we all kind of do it in different ways. I also I'm always curious about how people experience their own fandom in terms of Disney's a good example because Disney is a place where those people, a lot of people who are huge fans of it, have experienced it almost 100 times or they go a lot.
Yeah.
So they're re-experiencing the same thing over and over, which is I think a lot of fandom kind of centers on, right?
Oh, yeah. So repetition. Because a lot of people use it for mood regulation and a self-care element. Mm. Some people, I'm sure you have that friend or are that friend who puts on reruns of Supernatural or Seinfeld or Friends on in the background when you're doing other things. Parks and Rec.
Office, yeah.
When you're doing other things, to have those familiar voices in your space because they feel like friends.
Yeah, it's the blanket.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, there are a lot of warm fuzzies there. And so that's another thing that way that people express fandom and role that it serves in people's lives is to be there as a stable thing in a world of instability.
Oh, wow. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So one of the things you talk about is the shared values within fandoms. What does that mean?
Well, there are a lot of fandoms that have a lot of different pockets of values, and you can see that with anything really, really big. There are some that are very, very cohesive in terms of belief systems and the ways that people want to see the world to change and what they find good. One of my favorite examples, I have a few favorite examples of this, but Harry Potter is one of them.
Woohoo!
Where
if you see
a woman in her 30s wearing any kind of nerd merch who has voted in every election that she's been eligible for, she's probably a Harry Potter fan.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. You described me. I'm in.
Right. Because it raised an entire generation and it's a female fandom of a specific era. People are experiencing it now, but not quite in the same heat and fervor necessarily
as far as
the culture is concerned. And for me, I still consider myself a Harry Potter fan, despite not particularly enjoying the new canon. Mm-hmm. I'm still a Harry Potter fan.
Why do you consider it a female fandom?
Because it skews female.
Does it statistically?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yes.
I thought it did because I used to teach a Harry Potter themed theater class back in Portland. We taught it for 20 years because it never would not sell out. And I would say, in general theater classes, there's more girls than boys. But that Harry Potter class, yeah, there was always more girls than boys for the most part.
Yeah.
That was pretty crazy.
Small sample size, same result.
But yeah, young adult literature caters to a largely female audience.
Because
they
can read and boys can't. I am a terrible scientist because I just make statements and never back anything up.
Why probably has to do with the shared values of transformation and learning and personal growth. I mean, I still read YA and I'm in my 30s because the story of personal growth and transformation will never stop being relevant in my life.
Sure.
And
absolutely.
Puberty and high school, college age, when life just moves so quickly and everything changes so fast, that era is just a quintessential time for learning and change and growth. And so there's something there that just caters to people who are really interested in that character-driven arc, as opposed to plot-heavy action sequences where there's lots of action and stuff happening. That character-driven arc of YA is often really appealing for people who are particularly interested in creating
social
change
justice.
And social justice. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I have a very, very dark example that came up in the news a couple weeks ago that I wonder if you could weigh in on through this lens. It was about Avengers Endgame and some horrible, evil person online recut it, took out the women and minorities and posted it on YouTube and was like, here's how it should have been. What is wrong with that person and why did their fandom drive them to do this horrible thing?
So from where I sit, it's a horrible thing, but also there's, if fandoms are places where people seek refuge to find like-minded people, and if you are a person who grew up in an age, which is not our age, where people were persecuted for being nerds and geeks, and they sought refuge in their comic book stores, then it's that same thing that's happening politically, where equality feels like a removal of rights or an invasion of spaces, when really it's equality. And
they're not used to it.
Of your level of privilege is not being changed. Other people are being elevated to that level, but you feel like something's being
changed. Especially if you were the person who sought refuge in your comic book store from the cool popular kids, or were shamed for what you like. The thought of it mainstreaming at all, and mainstreaming means, you know, it's finding a more general audience, including women and minorities.
Yeah.
And also it negates it. I mean, part of that with me, it would be remiss of me to not talk about Afrofuturism and Black nerd culture that historically has been prevalent in nerd culture for a very long time, just not necessarily been like merged with I'm about to say something particularly offensive.
We welcome that here.
But it hasn't traditionally been merged with like nerd Gen X culture. And
was Gen X the offensive part?
I can't believe you just said
How
that.
Dare you?
Yeah, get I mean, it out. Was a little bit of ageism on my part, but like there are clear lines between, you know, millennials and Gen Z with regards to our generational opinions on diversity and inclusion. And that starts to split, especially according to, like, if you see Pew Research or if you've seen some of the, like, ad research on that follows, like, I don't know if you saw the ad research about the Kaepernick Nike ad about where people get offended and based on age and
oh,
political
man.
Affiliation
Such
and stuff
a good
like
ad.
That. Yeah, but there's a lot of research around that ad, and so you can see a lot of these generational divides as well.
But that's true for a lot of social progress, isn't it? Like, generationally, they're just everybody's slow on the uptick on things in terms of, like,
yeah,
right?
And
because,
I mean,
the people before them, the boomers, are even worse statistically on the bar.
Right, and except for when they were young and they were hippies.
Right, right.
Because there's a life stage, there's a generational thing and a life stage thing, and those are two totally different things.
Yes.
But yes, young people tend to be more inclusive and progressive than older people.
Yes.
All right. Well, we have
apologies
so many...
for the ageism.
It was a factual observation, nothing ageist about it. All right. Because every Gen X listener of this show is an outlier because they're listening to me.
Bunch of weirdos.
All right. Well, we have to take a short break, but when we come back, we are going to dive into the difference between an influencer and a celebrity. And we have so much more to ask Meredith. So stay tuned.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome back. Our guest today is Meredith Levine. There's Jake.
Hi.
There he is. Meredith is a fanthropologist, and we've been deep diving on what that even means because it's such an exciting, interesting field of study. We have so many questions. The next being, what is the relationship that influencers have with their fans versus the relationship that celebrities have with their fans?
Ooh. So we're in an influencer economy. Obviously, you're listening to a podcast right now. But influencers tend to have these things called parasocial relationships, where part of their appeal is you get to know them through a lot of content that they make and produce and distribute on their own. And as a result, you wind up with an audience that knows a lot more about an influencer than the influencer could ever possibly know about their audience. And that influencer is giving away a lot of that information a lot of the time. And
I know nothing about that.
and through that regular sustained content of self-producing, you wind up with an audience that feels a lot more like a friend or feels like an influencer is more of a friend than an unapproachable celebrity. If you were to have, you know, Jenna Marbles and Beyonce in the same room, you would have a lot of people going up to Jenna Marbles asking for a hug and saying, "Oh my God, did you see that Beyonce is here?" Because it's a different level of approachability,
they
and it's a different level.
They feel that connection's personal, right?
Right. There's a personal connection where, like, you would go up to someone in Target and be like, "Hey, how is your something something that you just talked about in your vlog last week?"
That's so interesting how that, because now that I think about it, I'm going through the influencers that I'm a fan of in my head. I'm like, oh, I guess I would feel comfortable talking to those people more than
Jon Favreau and John Lovett, Tommy Vietor, Dan
Sure,
Piper,
like
all
you
my best
feel
friends.
You could drop into those conversations, right, Becca? As opposed
I do.
To
I was shouting out Pod Save America, my favorite podcast. Wow, that's so interesting. By this standard, if you knew this going into it, who would ever want to be a celebrity in those contexts?
I mean, you wind up with a lot of trade-offs in either of them because, one, you get universally recognized of everywhere you go for your work. Mm. And that's another big distinction is, like, celebrities are often separated from their work. Like, Taylor Swift, I mean, she has more influencer tendencies than a lot of celebrities do, but people tend to be a fan of her work. More so than, like, I mean, her cats are pretty famous, too. So
But her music is bigger than necessarily just her as the, right. I get what you're saying, yeah.
Right.
Or like Amy Adams.
Right.
I don't know anything about her as a person, but I love her acting.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you wind up with that differentiation versus if you watch, you know, YouTubers, it may feel like you know them. And I know a lot of YouTubers, so I know them. But when I ever go into, like, a studio office like this one or, like, BuzzFeed or something, I forget that some people in that office I know in real life, and then other people in that office I've only ever seen in video.
Yeah, I do.
I'm like, wait, no, I can't transition this conversation because there hasn't been an introduction yet, despite the fact that, like, I feel like I know you.
Right.
And so those lines get really, really blurred. Because of that feeling like you know somebody, even if you don't.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it depends on how private of a person you are. Some celebrities may much prefer that, and some influencers may think, that sounds terrible for people to not want to come up to me.
Right, and part of it also depends on if you're building your business off of a personal brand or you're building your business off of a craft. So, like, you wind up with the, like, building YouTubers who, like, make prop replicas or de-rust ancient weaponry.
Sure.
Or whatever they're doing. And so that's a lot more of, like, a skill-based thing where they're known for
what they do,
not necessarily who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Because in some fields you can separate out what you do from who you are.
Mm. Yeah, so there's a
gradient. Love that idea that you were talking about of, you didn't say the reverse part of it. So a celebrity is known for their craft and they're valued by their work versus the other side of that is that an influencer can do a whole bunch of mediocre work, but you love them as the person. So it kind of, they're elevated above the work they
do. I don't think there's a judgment necessarily that their work's good or not. She's just saying they're known for
influence. They're known for something else. They're known for their relationship with their audience.
Yes.
Not the work that they do. And the reality is what's being monetized is the relationship in either case. It's just when you're an influencer, and I hate that word because that word is basically making a career call based on a monetization model, not necessarily like what is being made. So creators call themselves creators, but when you're talking to advertisers and in the business world, it's often influencers. Anyhow,
yeah.
That monetization model is the same. It's just when you are an influencer or a creator, you are doing the writing, directing, producing, editing, distribution all on your own. And so you're much closer to your audience than being, I'm going to do some air quotes here for those of you who are listening, quote unquote talent, which means you show up, you do your thing, and then everything else gets handled by other people. And granted, everything is a team sport. Like, there are audio engineers and mixers, and shout out to the people in the booth. But that process is much more truncated. So creators and influencers are much closer to their audience than going through layers of editors and mixers and SFX artists and makeup artists and like all of the other people who are involved. Because if you were an editor or a special effects artist on Avengers, your work is really important in that contribution to the fandom, but no one's going to stop you in Target to say, I loved your work on the Avengers.
Yeah. Also, Brie Larson's not going to Target anymore.
She's probably Postmating and getting everything delivered.
Yeah, probably. For a second, I pictured her driving the Postmates car, and then I was like, what? Oh, yeah. No,
yeah,
no, that's
just, yeah, yeah.
Should we talk about the cult thing?
Sure.
Okay, where is the line between fandom and cultdom? This is Jake's question, so Jake, elaborate. I stole your question.
So I'm pretty sure that cults have some hard line rules as far as defining them to be cults. One is forcing separation between you and the people you love who are non-members, and the other has to do with like devotion and dedication of resources towards the communal cause.
So I mean, those are the big ones, obviously. But like, I'm talking about where the border is a little bit. So there's obviously some clear-cut ones, like, you know, it requires obedience or anything like that, or like monetary requirements or whatever. I'm talking about, oh, go ahead.
I expect people to listen to this podcast and obey,
or just question your beliefs. But what I want to know is like where it you are your own time and your own lifestyle starts to revolve around your fandom, and maybe your life choices are defined by your fandom. Ooh. Or one starts to take over the other.
I think often if those are choices as opposed to coercion, like it's what's the difference between good and evil? I think it's fine if you have, you know, if you're the kind of person who lives by the code of the Jedi and that is your moral framework, and that's fine.
Is everybody who's coerced into something not making a choice as well?
Yes.
Yes. By definition, being coerced is you didn't have a choice in it, right?
Someone was tricking or manipulating you into doing something.
That, right. But then can there be cults that aren't coercing people, even if they're based on true information?
Well, then you have the second bullet point, which was that you have to give something back.
Right. You're donating your resources and your time and your life into this organization that is demanding it from you. Like most people who have really active lives in fandom, it's not being demanded and they could stop when they wanted or transition it to somebody else and have community support in what they're doing and can build their own networks of support and health and reach people outside of it. It's not like they stop seeing their friends and family if their friends and family aren't fans of what they're fans of.
Yeah, no kidding.
Fair enough. Okay, so not a cult.
Not a cult.
To pivot that question, is there a point when in your research you've come across fandoms that have become unhealthy? Is that a thing?
There's a big difference between being a cult and having schisms or toxicity in a fandom. Big difference. Because one is a difference of opinion and morality that is clashing, and the other is something that is by and large not good for humanity, i.e. a cult. And fandom and cults are not the same thing, but there is toxicity in fandom, and that comes down to the very human experience of fandoms are bigger than the amount of people than we can personally know. And when you exceed the amount of people that a community can personally know and trust, there are often lines divided in the sand on some ideological marker or function or whatever that will split a community. Mm-hmm. And then when you have that community split, that's not necessarily unamicable. Sometimes it's amicable, but sometimes you wind up with other lines being drawn that are less amicable, where you have these new Marvel movies were made for me because I am a woman camp, and it's okay if they weren't made for you because you had an entire history of superhero movies being made for you for the last, you know,
forever,
50 to 60 years.
Yeah.
Like those two camps have some friction there because there's the, well, well, I'm seeing myself being represented less, and the I'm seeing myself being represented more as seen as competing objectives.
And yet the release schedule is still on track for white males.
And not to like totally knock down like that section of the world or the audience, just to say that when those feel like they're in friction instead of in harmony, you can wind up with a lot of tension, because fandom is a marker of identity. And when I see someone wearing Harry Potter merch, I'm making a political assumption about them.
Right.
Very clearly. And if I'm wrong, I'm wondering, wait.
Who let you in our club?
Or like, how did you find this? And what about this is speaking to you?
Yeah.
Is really the question I have. Is like, what about this is speaking to you if you're not seeing what I'm seeing? And there's a concept in a lot of blockbuster film called left cycles and right cycles, in that there are storylines and subplots and themes that can be read in either side. Ooh. And in either direction.
Mm-hmm. Like the Colbert Report.
Yeah. So Star Wars is a really good example of this, because it's a Western. And so with a lot of that like Western structure, you wind up with a lot of traditional ideology and traditional hero's journey narratives and stuff like that baked in. But then you overlay science fiction, which is a setting and oftentimes comes along with the like Star Trekian infinite diversity, infinite combinations of like that being represented, and like aliens and non-human entities often being representative of the other and the way that they're like treated in certain universes. And so you wind up with two different ways to read the same story. But there are some stories where you're just like, wait, how did you find this, and why do you like this if we're not sharing values?
Right. What you're talking about makes me think of a big leap I made, which I'm sure someone else has already made, that fandoms are the new religion, because religion was created. There was a researcher, and I don't remember his name, but he's been on a podcast I've listened to, that studies the way that religion used to influence. When you can't know everyone in your society, it helps to have these defining factors. And if you fear the same God, then you must have the same moral structure, and therefore I can trust you in my society. And fandom is the evolved version of that, okay, well, I know that if you are a fan of Harry Potter, then you probably have the same moral alignment than I do, and we're in the same monkey sphere. There you go.
Oh, yeah.
Figured it out.
Because you need proxies. You need proxies for trust when you're living in a really densely packed world with lots of strangers in it. And that speaks to a lot of the urban-rural divide as well. Is there a lot of proxies for trust when you live in a city, because you're just exposed to a lot more people? Whereas if you are in the town you grew up in, and it's a small town, and you've never left, you can know everybody. And so those proxies for trust don't necessarily need to exist, because there's actual literal trust. And without those proxies for trust, it's harder to figure out who to trust as someone who's not from your community, because those proxies haven't been built in and those cultural signals aren't there. And we're culturally signaling all the time with absolutely everything we do. And so to be able to read and interpret those signals is also really important when building trust and rapport with people. And sometimes shared fandom. So some people would say, you know, fandom and religion aren't alike, because religion is often also tackling like metaphysical concepts like what happens when you die, or like morality. I would say that fandom has a morality play in it also, and you don't need religion for morality. You can have a lot of things that structure around morality. But yeah, when fandom isn't always talking about the metaphysical of like what happens when you die, or why are we here? Like, religion tries to answer some of those big questions, where fandom doesn't necessarily try and answer some of those big questions, but functionally, yeah, as far as building groups and social structures of trust and sameness, fandom can do that.
Yeah, totally. But if you don't know, then you may have to improvise, which segues into the type of game we want to talk about.
Woo! Yes!
So, you're a fan of what I'm going to call, or you have called, write a thing on a slip of paper and put it in a hat games.
I love write a thing on a slip of paper and put it in a hat games.
It's a well-known genre.
I was a theater nerd. Does it show?
We're also theater nerds.
Yeah, we play lines from a hat.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk about, let's see. Where I grew up, we called this game Pimp Cup. But a lot of people know it as...
When I was in kindergarten, yeah, we called it Pimp Cup.
We played Pimp Cup in kindergarten. A lot of people call it Celebrity. And there's mm-hmm. recently been a published version called Time's Up, which I think was right before, you know, Hollywood decided to mm-hmm. take that hashtag
back. Yeah.
And this is, tell me if you know this game, 3 rounds.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. That's all I had to say. Done.
3 rounds.
You go.
Because,
you tell.
Well, because you have, if... Well, the universal first round is, or at least one of the rounds is straight up charades.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I love this game, and I've played this game at, like, conferences. I've played this game at sleepovers. I love this game, where you have people contribute slips of paper into...
into the pimp cup.
And, or the hat, or the whatever, yeah.
Well, whatever. We played with a big bejeweled goblet.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Some people play with, like, popcorn or salad bowls or whatever. Whatever you have, into the receptacle, and then...
The pimp receptacle.
The pimp receptacle. And so you write whatever it is, and it can be a whatever. Some people have parameters for whatever you put in.
Is it usually celebrities?
It can be a celebrity. It has to be something everyone knows. It can be Santa Claus.
Yeah, it has
can
to be common, right?
It can be the New Yorker magazine.
Right.
It can be whatever.
We got one of my favorites that ended up being a great inside joke were jelly pens.
Oh, that's a good one.
Jelly shoes.
Yeah, those are like Ooh. Some generational items
yeah.
there.
Yes.
But round one is like a taboo situation where you can say the thing, but like not the thing. You can talk
Everything
around
it. But what's written on the
right.
slip.
Or any of the like broken component parts of what's on the slip. So you talk around the idea and then you put everything back and then you have one word to judge the idea. And go around again, but everyone's already heard everything that's in the hat, so it should, in theory, be easier.
So, magazine, the New Yorker,
right?
It, yeah,
right. Or like writing, jelly pens,
obviously.
And so you wind up with that round, and then the last round is strictly charades, no sound effects, no talking, but you've already heard these things twice, and so in theory, it should be easier. But how's somebody gonna do, you know? New Yorker magazine without having all of those rounds of in-jokes.
Right.
In
it's
between.
All about the in-jokes.
It's all about the in-jokes.
Yes.
Because at that point, you have like all of the conversation to draw on if your item happens to be particularly
You've
challenging.
You've created a
or,
new context
right.
for that thing. Even though everybody has a shared context for a celebrity like the New Yorker, you had some in-joke that you created
right.
the first 2 rounds.
Or like Keanu Reeves or whatever.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just thinking about the last time I played this with family. I play this game a lot with friends, but with family, I played... with my cousin Alejo, and Alejo just wrote obscure 1950s baseball players no one had heard of with foreign sounding names. And then my aunt Kate, she was the only person of the parents' generation to be playing this game with all me and my cousins. And Kate goes up, she goes, I'm not gonna know any of these, as she's chewing her Nicorette gum furiously as she does and has for 30 years. And we start the timer, she pulls the first name out of the hat, she goes, I don't know that, throws it on the ground, grabs another, I don't know this, throws it on the ground, I don't know this, throws it on the ground. It was the funniest thing that's ever happened to me because she did it to the entire bowl.
What? No.
As
the whole bowl?
We were yelling, only throw them on the ground if you get it right, otherwise put it back in the bowl. And so her son is running around, picking him up, putting him back in the bowl, and she's yelling, I don't know this. Anyway, that's the visual that came in my head where I just started laughing to myself and I had to explain why I was doing that.
Well, I think that's really a fascinating thing about like the play the player games is it forces you to have a lot of empathy about the people around you.
Sure.
Yeah.
Like you have to acknowledge, like when I'm playing with friends, it's like, oh, we're almost all of the same age. A lot of us grew up in cities. We have a lot of the same cultural references. Like it'll be fine. But playing with people who you barely know or who are way older or way younger, it forces you to think about what are these people actually going to know that everybody else will also know.
That's a slam on Gen Xers, right? Nice. High five.
Yeah.
Nice. Good job.
Stupid Gen Xers.
Yeah.
Stupid.
Good point,
so
Meredith.
Stupid.
Good point.
Andrew, our producer, points to himself.
I mean, there are a lot of shared cultural references like across the board, but if I were to do like beach blanket bingo, that's a reference that my parents will get
sure.
that people my age will barely understand, and it's a family in joke because we know people who were in it, But like,
wait, what is this? Is this a movie?
Oh, this is a series of movies hosted by, I think his name is Frankie Avalon.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
he had a cameo in Full House. That's why I know who that is.
Okay. So it's the series of like beach, cheesy beach movies. Like, oh God, what was like that season? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Just like that.
And it's
just
clearly
like that.
Parts of it are clearly on a set that like looks like a beach.
Right.
And you have family members in this film?
We know someone who is in it.
Oh my gosh.
My family grew up in LA. Or at least my dad's side of the family is in LA. And so we know some people who were in it. But we know. But again, if I were to put that in the hat for you, again, you'd have like a, what is this?
But only in the first round.
Right.
That's the beauty of this game. You can bring together cultural references from everyone who's playing from disparate walks of life or generations. And this game is particularly suited, whatever you want to call it, to bring those people to talk and laugh about all these things. Unless you are my cousin Lei, who just put in obscure Japanese names of 1950s baseball players.
Oh, Japanese. Even harder.
Even harder.
Yeah.
Japanese
it was like
players from the 50s?
Beach blanket bingo.
You could at least sound
I can
out the
say
component
those words.
Parts. Yeah. You could at least act out those component parts.
I can.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jeez, Aleha.
But that intergenerational thing, I think, is like a really big perk of board games. I was visiting my mother and some of her side of the family, and I have cousins. My father was the youngest of three. My father is 8 years older than my mother. My mother is the oldest of three.
Oh.
And so my first cousins are 15 years older than me and 15 years younger than me.
Oh, no. You were stuck in the middle.
I have a sister, so we had each other.
We were both stuck in the middle.
We're both stuck in the middle, but I was playing with my younger cousins, and we were playing apples to apples, actually. So different game, different mechanic. But that intergenerational thing was still a thing to think about because I grew when they were born, I was in high school, and then I went off to college and didn't really see them. And now that they're teenagers and like approaching their teenage years, like early teenagers, 12, 13 years old, we came back and hung out with them. And I'm like, oh, man, like this is a play the player game. And I don't actually know them that well. But like through playing, it was easy to suss out where their humor was when they were like, oh, that was the card that I put in and I thought it was really funny, or I have no idea who this is. Like in understanding the way that they were playing, it became a lot easier to understand how to play to them. And because it's such a play the player game of matching humor and relating via humor, it was a lot easier to kind of get to know their values and frameworks based on what they find funny, based on how they were playing.
Absolutely.
Which, like, I wouldn't have been able to do had they not been old enough to play and understand it. And I also wouldn't have had the opportunity to do because of that generational gap.
Don't you find that humor is, like, one of the best ways to relate to a person in a way?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that a lot of the, like, party-style games really rely on humor because that's, like, if you're our age, it's great to do at a party over some adult beverages. But, like, even as kids, that humor is still a relatable thing and a way to break ice.
Well, because play in general, like, lowers our barriers a lot. Like, mm-hmm. We tend to get a little less insecure a little bit. We tend to open up and trust each other a little bit more and forget those boundaries. And so people open up themselves and actually take a little bit of risks, right? In games and in, like, improv.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. In theater games and in tabletop games. And when you're able to relate to other people and have those laughing moments and, you know, play is supposed to be fun. Otherwise, it would be called work,
yeah.
Right?
Sure.
And so when you can have that amount of fun over something that is structured enough for everyone to participate, like, unstructured play can be challenging because, like, when I was in college and my cousins were, like, the imaginative play, unstructured era of here are these pictures in their minds that I'm so jealous that they had the ability to play with that I, like, now struggle. I need more structure in order to get into an imaginative place now. Like, that was a harder bridge to cross.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, having the structure of a game that includes humor and is a play-the-player game is a really great bonding experience in my experience.
Absolutely. And to have that excuse to let down all of your guards and let your inner child flourish with parameters around it, because that's what we as improvisers and performers are always trying to get back to, is that sense of just unbridled play.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great to have fun. Yeah. I wish we had more of it.
Well said. Yeah. Well, on that note, it's great to have fun. We hope you guys had fun listening to this podcast. Meredith, if there's anything that you'd like to shout out, someplace people can read more about your work or the more of the world of Phanthropology, what should they Google?
Probably my name and the word Phanthropologist. I'm easily reachable on Twitter at Meredith Jean. Other than that, I'm not super on the internet because a lot of my research is actually for private companies, but I talk every once in a while at places, and I will announce that on my Twitter in the event that I'm doing that. So you can, if you're in LA or around LA, you can reach me on Twitter or find out if I'm saying something somewhere via my Twitter.
Amazing.
Right on.
Meredith Levine, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Jake, thanks for being here.
Becca, thanks for having me.
And thanks to you at home or in your car or wherever you are listening to this podcast. Please subscribe and like and share and rate it and tell your friends to listen to Victory Points. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.